It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We will be issuing document requests to over 60 different people and individuals from the White House to the Department of Justice, Donald Trump Jr., Alan Weisselberg, to begin the investigations, to present the case to American people about obstruction of justice, corruption, and abuse of power.
I cooperate all the time with everybody. And you know the beautiful thing? No collusion. It's all a hoax. You're going to learn about that as you grow older. It's a political hoax.
Nadler is setting the framework now that the Democrats are not to believe the Mueller report. They're now saying we have to do our own investigation.
Sandy Rios with you. Yes, and that's how it is on this Tuesday in this world in which we live, March the 5th. Can you believe it? 2019. So Gerald Nadler, now as the new House Judiciary Committee, has announced, as you just heard in his own words, documents from 60 different Trump associates. They're just trying to find anything and everything they can possibly find. 60 of them. They want to dig up information on the president's finances. They want to subpoena his taxes. They want to subpoena all the people that ever worked for him and their personal information. And so they want to look into his personal business, his campaign, his the goings on, as it's referred to as in the White House. And Nadler himself says, we can't depend on the Mueller investigation for this. Because the Mueller investigation is about to wind down and from all reports doesn't have anything. The president responded by tweeting, I am an innocent man being persecuted by some very bad, conflicted and corrupt people in a witch hunt that is illegal and should never have been allowed to start, and only because I won the election. Despite this, great success. And I think there's no exaggeration from the president's part on that. It really is pretty disgusting. Byron York has written a really great piece in the Washington Examiner tracking this, and he says the message is clear. Impeachment is on. Let me read a little bit about what Byron says here. Nadler says it's very clear that the president obstructed justice. It's very clear. 1,100 times he referred to the Mueller investigation as a witch hunt. He tried to. He fired. He tried to protect Flynn from being investigated by the FBI. He fired Comey in order to stop the Russian thing, as he told NBC News. He's dangled part. He's threat. He's intimidated witnesses in public. All right, so, you know, slow down a minute, Mr. Nadler. Honestly, the president saying that Mueller investigation is a witch hunt does not obstruct justice. It didn't affect Mueller's investigation at all. As we all know, he has no power to affect it, and he has no power to stop it, and he can't stop the process. So there's nothing wrong with the president saying that he doesn't like it and he thinks it's a witch hunt. Also that he tried to protect Flynn from being investigated. He basically said to Comey, I hope you'll go, you know, you'll see it to go. Lieutenant General Flynn is a good man. I hope you will, you know, see your way clear. I think he said to go easy on him or something like that. But it was just a suggestion. We have the exact words because Comey wrote it in his memo. It was not. Now, I expect you to go lightly on Lieutenant, or don't you dare, or he didn't even tell him what to do. He just said he's a good man. I hope you'll keep that in mind. He's a really good man. And so these allegations, of course, are said in such a way as to make them sound as though they are criminal when they really aren't. And so Byron goes on in his article to say, to quote Nadler, Nadler says, we have to do the investigation and get all this. We do not now have the evidence all sorted out and everything to do an impeachment. Before you impeach somebody, you have to persuade the American public that it ought to happen. You have to persuade enough of the opposition party voters, Trump voters, that you're not just trying to steal the last to reverse the results of the last election. So you see, it's interesting, isn't it, to hear his words? And so Byron goes on to say, absolutely. He's talking about all these other committees going after Chairman Representative Richard Neal of Massachusetts is asking his staff to prepare a request to the Internal Revenue Service, the president's tax returns. They're investigating his kids, his staff, everything. So Byron again says the impeachment decision has been made. And so that's clearly what we're seeing come up here. And you know, one of the reasons why I think this is so important, and to put it in perspective, I've talked to you a great deal about the people that have been destroyed that you have seen. I talked about Paul Manafort, innocent or not, he's certainly not guilty of any collusion with the Russians on behalf of the Trump campaign. We know that, and that's why he was put under such scrutiny. And now, from all reports, he's near death. He's been held in solitary confinement. Then, of course, we have Lieutenant General Flynn, who has been ruined financially, and his family. And that's just two to speak of. But there's another article that came out in the Washington Times the end of February talking about other collateral damage, talking about people who have whose careers have been ruined, like Carter Page, who's had so many death threats, and they go into great detail about those death threats. Mr. Mueller, by the way, has filed more than 100 public charges against 34 individuals and three companies. And these companies are Russian companies, in some cases anonymous. And I don't think he ever expected them to fight back, but these anonymous Russian companies, at least one of them, are fighting back. And also Michael Caputo, who was a communications consultant who worked on the Trump campaign, has been living a nightmare. During a hearing, Congresswoman Jackie Speier of California, a Democrat from California, referred to Mr. Caputo as Russian President Vladimir Putin's image consultant. And after that, Mr. Caputo said his reputation just dropped. He said he's had death threats, if they've topped 50 right now, threats against his family. It's coming in letters and phone calls. The local police are verifying this. Mrs. Speier's response to this was, welcome to the crowd. We get death threats all the time. And there are several people mentioned in this article. We put this on our Facebook page because I think it's worth reading. It's exclusive, collateral damage. Russia probe spurs death threats, financial ruin for those not even charged. And so the other interesting thing, there was a poll, a Newsbusters came out with an interesting observation. They polled a different viewers of different networks, and they found that 99% of CNN viewers think that President Trump lied about Russia. 84% of Fox viewers believe the president has been truthful. And so, when asked about by the Democratic pollster Fred Yang, asked about what does this tell us, he says it tells us that you get your reality from what channel you watch, and therefore you see how dangerous the news media can be. And it certainly is dangerous. One other thing, there are several things about this probe that I wanted to mention to you, and I'll just mention this one. You remember that last week when Michael Cohen came before the Oversight Committee, there were so many things to say about that that never got said. For one thing, you know that the Republicans on that committee didn't even get the statement that Cohen was going to make. They did not get a transcript of it like the Democrats did. The Democrats got it the night before. The Republicans got it like 30 minutes before the hearing began. CNN got the transcript before the Republicans on that committee got it. And the reason they need it, of course, is because they have to prepare their case, their questions. They have to kind of know what the witness is going to say. And so that was just part of it. And in the course of that, of course, Michael Cohen contradicted himself countless times. And Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan have both now referred Michael Cohen for more criminal charges, and they cite six different lies that he told under oath and under testimony to the Congress. So that's, you know, an unfortunate, sad thing for a man like Michael Cohen, but that was the catalyst for which Gerald Nadler then said that he felt like he had to go on and explore the things that Michael Cohen said so that they could further investigate the president and his family. One other thing, the Christopher Steele deposition. Christopher Steele is the British agent who allegedly prepared that tabloid dossier on the president. He is the British agent who hated the president and wanted to do anything to stop him from becoming president. He was the agent paid by the Hillary Clinton and the DNC, by Hillary Clinton's campaign and the DNC. That's who funded the dossier, which was handed, now we know, by James Clapper to CNN, who leaked it. And then BuzzFeed, who, after the FBI director, Comey, went to see President Trump allegedly to let him know as a courtesy about this dossier. It was then published by CNN almost immediately, and then BuzzFeed published the entire thing almost immediately. And it was, we know now, a complete setup, a cooperation by the FBI director, by the Steele dossier, paid for by the Clinton campaign. It's just, it is so dirty. It really, talk about a dirty dossier, but the whole process also was so dirty. John McCain, part of it too, sending someone overseas to pick up a copy of the dossier, then feeding it himself to other outlets. And I would just want to remind you again, I read that dossier to you, at least parts of it, on the air when it first came out. And I said right up front, this is absolutely outrageous. It's ridiculous. It doesn't even make sense. This is just nonsense. You don't read it and say, wow, this is really bad. Even if you like the president, you might think, oh, I hope this isn't true. You knew it wasn't true. It was written. It was silly, silly information. Any reasonable person, certainly any journalist who's used to going through a lot of content knew, and that's why it had not been published up to that point. And yet it was used to go into the FISA court to come after all of these people that we've mentioned and outlined. It is just one of the biggest. It is, without doubt, the biggest scandal, the most far-reaching scandal we have ever experienced in this country. Watergate is nothing by comparison, absolutely nothing. And so yet we're still left with this, you know, remaining couple of years of the president's term to go through these, for the president and the people who are associated with him, to go through these hoops, to be ruined financially, to be chased, to be have papers and documents demanded from them when there's no crime. I mean, if there's a crime, I think we would know about it by now. Do you not think that people have not gotten a hold of the president's tax records? You know, remember the New York Times published those about a year ago, and it was just like a big yawn. Someone had already leaked those. So if you think that people have not already explored every avenue of Donald Trump's business dealings, his taxes, his children, honestly, I find it amazing that they have not found more than they found. Truly, I do. I think it's amazing. I think I would have to say that if you consider your own personality, your own entity, if you had been in his shoes as a multi-billion-dollar playboy businessman with no religious compass, very little, being raised Presbyterian marginally, how would you have conducted your life? You know, what would you have said? How many women would you have slept with? I think we apply our Christian standards to him, which we can't, because they didn't apply to him. He is a lost man. He was a lost man. I hope he isn't now, but he certainly was. And so when we start to criticize him for doing what men in their natural way do, with almost out exception, I think we just don't understand. But anyway, that's the president of the United States. They're going to be pursuing and looking for anything they can find to further destroy him before he runs in 2020. There's just no question about that. Oh, I had so many more things to say, but I have to say them in the last segment, because coming up next, Rachel Bovard will join us. Rachel has written a really great piece on that Born Alive Infant Protection Act, the inside story of this on Capitol Hill, what happened in Congress, what Mitch McConnell did and did not do, what the Democrats are doing, and what the pro-life movement did and did not do, and what's next. So I hope you'll stay tuned. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Here's some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or more importantly, if you sign up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare, and MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing program. It's been around for 25 years. They have more than 400,000 members now around the country. And get this, over the years, MediShare members have shared more than $2 billion of each other's medical bills, so they could help share your needs too. And best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is around $500 a month. Your savings could be more or less, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. So if you think you're stuck with a high-cost health plan that doesn't have much to offer, think again. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. There's no pressure. They're super easy to talk to. 833-44-BIBLE. That's 833-44-BIBLE. 833-44-BIBLE.
This is Pause to Pray, a moment each day to pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, a former appeals court judge and special prosecutor. Justice Breyer has served on the U.S. Supreme Court since 1994. Psalm 106:3 reminds us of the importance of justice under the law. Blessed are they who observe justice, who do righteousness at all times. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Oh, Heavenly Father, we ask you to guide Justice Breyer as he works in the name of justice for all Americans. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Fox News Commentary with Todd Starnes.
Hello, Americans. There's turbulence at John Wayne Airport. More next.
Truett McConnell University.
Hey, my name is Aaron Abbs. I am an undecided major, and I'm a freshman here at TMU. And as soon as I came here, I fell in love with the campus. Like, I knew, like, God was calling me to be here at TMU. And, you know, I couldn't get a better education than this. Like, professors who pray before class, who care about your spiritual walk with Christ. You are who you are, and they care about you.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
A columnist for the Los Angeles Times wants Orange County to rename the John Wayne Airport. Michael Hilzik is leading the charge, arguing the Duke must pay for his racist and homophobic views. The social justice crowd got all worked up after someone unearthed an interview John Wayne gave to Playboy magazine in 1971. His comments about blacks, gays, and young people have been called scandalous. John Wayne's family tells Fox News it's unfair to judge someone on something that was written or said nearly 50 years ago, and frankly, the beloved actor is not alive to defend himself. But critics contend John Wayne was a dedicated right-winger, and that should be enough to warrant a name change, and they will not be satisfied until he's scrubbed from Hollywood history. I'm Todd Starnes.
That's your Fox News commentary.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I think it's easy to argue that this emergency order, this executive order, goes against the will of Congress. Not all Congress, but the majority of Congress that passed the appropriation bill. I spoke to the president last night, and we had a good discussion. He says he understands where I'm coming from, and he didn't tell me we would never play golf again, so I don't know. It isn't about President Trump. It's about the division of power for me.
Sandy Rios back with you. The emergency order, of course, is to use some money to build the wall at the border, which is what the president campaigned on, which is what the American people are begging for. It's what we want. We want the immigration laws enforced. We want some sort of safety at the border to stop the infusion of what's coming across, whether it's drugs or human trafficking. And you fill in the blank. We talk about that enough. But what you don't know is now the Senate. We know that the House will resist the president's emergency declaration, but the Senate now, which is run by the Republicans, only needs 51 votes to pass this disapproval resolution. And Senator Rand Paul is that 51st vote. Lamar Alexander is jumping on the president about this. So is Senator Mitch McConnell, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Tom Tillis. And now there are other senators, probably Cory Gardner, Marco Rubio, Mitt Romney. They have not yet said how they'll vote. But basically, It's probably going to go, they are going to oppose officially the president's emergency order in the Senate. Rachel Bovard has joined me this morning to talk about other things, but I've asked Rachel to comment on this. What's going on there, Rachel? Good morning, by the way.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. So what you're seeing in the Senate is really sort of a jailbreak on this issue. A number of senators that you mentioned have come out, prominent senators saying, hey, you know, we oppose this. But really what's at work here, which is interesting to me, is that they're doing this because it's Donald Trump. Keep in mind that this is the Congress, the same Senate, the same Congress who's had no problem with national emergencies being declared, 30 of them that are still ongoing, 51 in total just in the last several decades. 18 of them have been used to transfer funds, just like Donald Trump is doing, from military to the border or to other areas. 18 of them have been used for things like building a courthouse in Guantanamo Bay or doing waterfront development in Bahrain. You didn't know there was a national emergency for that, but there is. So these guys have had no problem with presidents doing that. But because it's Donald Trump, they feel like they have to get all principled and constitutional about something that with previous presidents they've had no problem with.
Rachel, I wonder, I have a feeling that Rand Paul is not in that category. As always, he's kind of a unique bird there, but the others, absolutely. And the thing that really drives me crazy, and I'm sure this also drives you crazy, is that Leader Mitch McConnell could have something to do with this. He could have some influence, but as he always does, he leaves President Trump dangling out on a limb by himself, like he did with the shutdown. Gives no support, and sort of plays it both ways. I wonder how you see that.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch McConnell on this because, he said originally that, he would support the president in declaring this national emergency. But what I think is particularly interesting about how McConnell handles these things is that if it was just conservatives opposing this, the retribution would be swift and severe. And we've seen this before. When Mike Lee, when Ted Cruz, when Rand Paul, when it's the three of them standing up and saying no to something, McConnell responds. But when it's his allies, like Lamar Alexander or Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski or Tom Tillis, he doesn't bring the weight of his office against them. So there is definitely a difference in treatment in how he handles his allies versus conservatives. And I think you're seeing that play out here.
Yeah, I do too. And I just want to commend an article because I'm not going to get to go into this. This is by The Last Refuge, and it's entitled Beware Senator Mitch McConnell. And I think it's a really good article. It talks about his allies in the Senate, the Chamber of Commerce, and all the ones that we see standing behind him on a regular basis, and the game that he's playing. It's a dangerous game, and how he hates conservatives. Just to remind you, Rachel just hinted at that. Again, he is not our friend. He's not our friend. He is on some things, but not many, I have to say. And he's certainly no friend to the president. And I just want to say one more thing before we leave this subject, Rachel. It is infuriating. Is it not infuriating that they find their, their manhood to oppose something like this, which will actually help secure the border, but they can't find it on other things like what we're going to talk about next when it comes to saving human life? They oppose any kind of immigration restrictions, at least very little. And so they suddenly rise up and well in outrage about some executive order, which you've already said is a false outrage. But they can't find their outrage when it comes to saving human lives. I just find it exasperating. You have written a new article, which is the reason I wanted to talk to you. Rachel, you undoubtedly know I've talked about the Born Alive Infant Protection Act that was voted on a week ago yesterday in the Senate. So let's talk about that because you've just written a great article, Getting the Party of Infanticide on the Record. Give us a recap of what happened last Monday night in terms of the vote, what this should have done and what it didn't do.
Yeah, so the Senate Republicans, through the efforts of Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska, voted last Monday on a bill, as you mentioned, called the Born Alive Survivors Protection Act. And what this bill said was essentially, if babies survive abortions, and that is they are fully delivered, they deserve access to medical care. Basically, it's saying to doctors, hey, you need to treat this infant like you would treat any other infant. That's all it said. And this was brought to the floor in response to comments by Virginia's Democrat governor, Ralph Northam, who basically promoted infanticide on national radio. He said, look, a baby's born after an abortion, maybe we resuscitate it, but we'd keep it comfortable while the mother decides what to do. And I think the national outrage and horror is what prompted this vote. But as you mentioned, it did not pass. You saw 44 Senate Democrats vote against this very basic issue, which is basically to say, look, hey, a baby survives an abortion, it deserves access to medical care. They could not bring themselves to vote for that. They hid behind colloquialisms like, oh, women's health, saying this would restrict access to abortion. Both of those are fundamental lies. This has nothing to do with women's health. This has everything to do with a baby who's born kicking and screaming into the world. And second, it said nothing to restrict access to abortion or its methods. But again, you still saw 44 Senate Republicans vote against this. Lisa Murkowski was absent. She's always a swing vote on these issues. And Susan Collins voted against it as well.
You give some stats on babies who are born alive after as a result of abortions or after abortions, which I was amazed. Can you give those to us, just at least what you can know and how do you know that?
Well, it's interesting. Each state collects a lot of data on this, or the states that mandate it do. And we know that this happens. We've seen states like, I think it's Minnesota, 11 babies were born alive. In Arizona, there were three. In other states, in Florida, I think there was one. I mean, these babies born alive, it happens. People who'd like to say this is incredibly rare, it is not. And these are precious lives. I mean, we're not even talking about the precious lives of the unborn. We're talking about babies who have been born in the face of tremendous obstacles, meaning abortion, and they're just left to die on the table because they don't have this fundamental federal protection to life.
So now Democrats, and they're trying to defend themselves on this, have sort of deflected, and they have given responses like there are very few or late-term abortions are rare. Well, this is, as you point out, this is a very different topic. This is not a late-term abortion. This is a baby who's born, regardless of what period the abortion takes place, what period of the pregnancy, what phase. It's about their birth. It's about their life. It isn't about a late-term abortion, which is actually a different issue, which is really what that Kathy Tran in Virginia touched on, about removing all abortion restrictions and allowing abortion right up even to the due date. So they sort of used a little smokescreen there to cover themselves. But, you know, Rachel, you point out that people in the country, and I'm seeing this too, were absolutely, absolutely outraged by the news out of New York, out of Virginia, and even out of the vote in the Senate last Monday night. And it affected the polls. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was really a stunning development. There was a Marist poll taken shortly after Ralph Northam's comments, and you saw a 17-point voter identification swing. So 17 points between people who formerly identified themselves as pro-choice, now calling themselves pro-life, solely due to the national attention given to this issue because of Ralph Northam's comments and because of the Senate's vote. That is tremendous. And I cannot underscore that enough, because this is usually a very stable demographic. This is a very stable identification. It doesn't really swing. If it does, it's like, you know, a point or two. But 17 points on this issue tells us a lot as a pro-life movement. It tells us that when we tell the truth, or when Democrats accidentally tell the truth about what an abortion is and what is involved, and just the grotesque aspects of it, people respond. And that is a huge, huge lesson we can take from this issue.
Yeah, it is. But the other distressing thing to me is, now we already know that the Democrats are, I can't think of a kind word, they are degenerates on this issue. They are infanticide promoters. There is nothing I can say about them. That's the nicest words I can think of. We know that about them. But the Republicans, Rachel, they run on being pro-life. They run on it every time they talk about how pro-life they are and how bad Planned Parenthood is. And they promise they're going to do this and they're going to do that. And they do nothing. They do almost nothing, the bare minimum. And so one has to get a little skeptical here. They see the polls. They know the polls. Someone certainly reports Susan B. Anthony List is very close to the administration, to the certainly leadership in the Senate and House. I'm sure they've reported these polls, so it's really kind of a nice thing for them because, you know, these people will turn around and vote for them because they're, of course, pro-life. But the reality is what, Rachel?
Well, you know, the reality is, and I don't want to denigrate the fact that the Senate had this vote. I'm glad they did. I think, you know, pro-lifers are glad they did. So I want to commend the Senate for doing that. But what you touched on is something that's very important about the pro-life movement in Washington. And that is, you know, that they've been accepting a lack of effort on this issue for several years. And this vote, as good as it was, is still symptomatic of that. You saw the vote be scheduled on a Monday night, which is where we call them sort of bed check votes or throwaway votes, because we know not all members will be in town. And to prove that point, actually, Senators Tim Scott and Senator Cramer missed this vote because of flight delays, because every senator's flying back to Washington. You don't put votes on Monday night where you're worried about passing them. And that's, you know, obviously how the GOP leadership felt about this Born Alive vote. They scheduled it at a time when they knew all the members wouldn't be there. And then second, you know, they didn't give it the same treatment that we've seen other priority issues in the Senate get. A Middle East security bill in January of this year, McConnell kept bringing it to the floor repeatedly until it gained the necessary 60 votes. That's not something he intends to do with Born Alive. He telegraphed that. But, you know, we'd love to see him do it with other issues. If he doesn't want to do it with Born Alive, great. Let's do it on a prohibition to traffic in fetal, you know, baby body parts, or let's do it for conscience protections for doctors. But he has not telegraphed he's going to do any of that. And as a movement, we should not accept that lack of effort.
Yeah, you know, I have to point out that Middle East vote was about Syria, and it was a direct rebuke to President Trump. I just have to point out, he may have been passionate about not removing troops too quickly from Syria, but the net effect was it was a rebuke to the president. That was the one he was impassioned on. Now, on this issue, it's kind of a win-win for Mitch McConnell and the leadership because, again, they can get credit for being pro-life while they basically do nothing or as little as possible. And, you know, Rachel, I was, and perhaps you were there too, man. I didn't know you at that time, but when the baby body parts video was released by David Delayden, and the whole nation was just shaken and outraged, the ones that saw it, repulsed, motivated, many of us met in Ted Cruz's office for at least twice, three times, trying to encourage the Senate leadership and the Republican leadership, which they had both houses then, to be willing to shut down the government over the issue of defunding Planned Parenthood. And as long as I've been in Washington and as many things as I think I know and understand, I was appalled as I saw the pro-life groups basically cover for Republican leadership almost without exception. Students for Life was maybe the exception on that, and American Family Association was certainly the exception on that. But they did nothing. They were not willing. They promised, as you have pointed out in this article, hearings. Don't rock the boat. We'll do hearings for you when it doesn't matter. And honestly, Rachel, I'm sorry, I'm doing the interview for you, but I want to know what you think about that. Fill in the blanks, please.
Yeah, you've made a very compelling point here, and this is exactly illustrative of the lack of effort that we in the pro-life movement accept from the Republican leadership. As you point out, in 2015, those videos came out and they shook the earth. I mean, it was just example after example of what we've always said about Planned Parenthood, which is that they have no compassion for human life, that they're in it to make money off of abortion. And when this was put forward, the Republican leadership said, hey, look, there's nothing we can do. We can't do anything. We don't have 60 votes.
And we can't shut down the government. Heaven forbid.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Have a few hearings here. Let's head pat you with a few hearings and hopefully you'll go away and forget that we had this issue. And essentially that's what happened.
Hey, Rachel.
Zero action.
Yeah, zero, zero action. Zero. Zip. Ned. Nada. Which is what this reminds me of. Rachel, can you stay just for a minute after the break? Because what I want to ask you, I talk about this and then I leave people just dangling. And I wonder if you would have a suggestion about what we might do. I promise I'll just keep you a few minutes and then I'll let you go. Rachel Bovard is my guest. She works with Senator DeMint. She is the Senior Policy Director at Conservative Partnership. And we'll be right back after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
By mercy and truth, iniquity is purged, and by the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Brazil's newly elected president, Jair Bolsonaro, has committed himself to obliterating regressivism in his country. President Bolsonaro has focused his latest efforts in this ideological battle on ridding Brazil's classrooms and universities of Marxism, feminism, and sexual deviancy indoctrination. On the eve of his inauguration, Bolsonaro tweeted, "One of the goals to get Brazil out of the worst positions in international education rankings is to combat the Marxist rubbish that has spread in the educational institutions." The Brazilian people elected him to do this job, and he's making good on his promises.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Hello, I'm Gary Roby, host of Call to Worship, heard each Sunday on American Family Radio. This one-hour program will lead you in a special time of worship and praise. We will focus on God's Word, spoken, and in music. Call to Worship has a different topic each week as we glorify God together. Be sure to join us at 5 a.m. Central each Sunday for a Call to Worship right here on American Family Radio.
Bishop E.W. Jackson.
Every single one of us who's been saved was once on the other side. You know, the Bible says, "And such were some of you." Before I got saved, I knew things were wrong, but I figured as long as I didn't get caught, what difference did it make? But the thing is, he changes you down on the inside anyway, so that you don't want to do what's wrong.
The Marriage, Family, and Life Conference is coming June 20th through 22nd. Learn more and register at urbanfamilytalk.com.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. The Democrats have essentially admitted that Bob Mueller has nothing on Trump, and the Dems have essentially admitted that they don't either. Everyone now is expecting the Mueller report to be a dud. The Democrats are giving up on Mueller and launching other wild hair investigations with zero evidence of crimes. They're going after the president's tax returns, but the president has been audited by New York for decades. If there was anything there, they would have found it. They're going after him over the Trump Tower negotiations in Moscow, but there is no law against those conversations, and anyway, Trump pulled out of such talks when he got the nomination. And the meeting in Trump Tower turned out to be about adoption law and nothing else. The desperation of the Democrats is plainly evident. They've got nothing on the president. They just won't admit it.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The British government has announced its intention to take an important step in the fight against Iranian-backed terrorism. It's going to stop pretending there's a difference between members of the Iranian proxy militia Hezbollah, who engage in jihad directly, and those who form the organization's so-called political party. This step should end the Hezbollah demonstrations and fundraising operations in London, and quite possibly elsewhere in the European Union as well. That could prove devastating to Hezbollah's financial viability at a moment when its sponsors in Tehran are reeling from the effects of President Trump's economic sanctions. Since Hezbollah's operatives are propping up Maduro's odious regime in Venezuela, engaging in drug trafficking worldwide, threatening Israel, and running sleeper cells in the United States, every American should applaud the UK's initiative and call on the rest of Europe to follow its lead. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
When we talk about third trimester abortions, these are done with the consent of obviously the mother, with the consent of the physicians, more than one physician, by the way. And it's done in cases where there may be severe deformities, there may be a fetus that's non-viable. So in this particular example, if a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue. We want the decision to be made by the mothers and their providers.
Yeah, so that was Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, who, by the way, is still in place, no matter how outrageous that was. He is still in place along with his lieutenant governor. It's just no retribution. No retribution. No one seems to care. Rachel Bovard was my guest on the other side, and I've asked her to stay with me for a little bit here. She is with Conservative Partnership, which was founded by former Senator Jim DeMint. And Rachel is becoming a really trusted source for me on what's going on in Capitol Hill. So, Rachel, people have heard what we said in the earlier segment, and it's pretty frustrating, that's putting it mildly, what Republican leadership is not doing to save lives, to respond to these horrible stories. But what can people do? I mean, they ask me that all the time. I have suggestions, but I'd like to know what you say.
Well, I think it's really important, actually, how where the pro-life movement goes from here. And I think we need to support our leadership for Senate, or the Republican leadership. You put this bill on the floor, that's great, right? But we can't let the pressure off. And I think that's too much what the pro-life movement does. They accept this idea that, oh, well, we don't have 60, I guess we can't try anymore. And that is not, I can assure you that no other interest lobby in Washington does that. The Chamber of Commerce does not accept that. No interest lobby accepts that. So the pro-life movement shouldn't accept that either. I mean, they should be meeting with the leadership and saying, when is our next vote? Republicans have the majority in the Senate. When is our next vote on this? When are we going to have an amendment vote on this? When are we going to act on this? Not only, you know, to push this cause forward, but to make Democrats uncomfortable on this issue. People forget that this is exactly how we got the ban on partial birth abortion, was by repeatedly putting that vote on the Senate floor until Democrats were so uncomfortable and, you know, with the idea that they had to defend a partial birth abortion, that the bill passed. And that is the strategy I think the pro-life movement should employ when it comes to this, you know, infanticide issue, when it comes to any number of other issues.
You know, I think a couple of practical things come to my mind. I was encouraging people to call Senator McConnell's office and tell him to get serious about this. Whatever words they use, stop this. You have the power to use your power to get more votes to stop this process. And you need to push back and find your passion on this. But, you know, also we could put pressure on our pro-life organizations. I bet people donate to them left and right, Rachel. And they could do all number of things. I'm not even going to tell them what to do. I could just say they could communicate to the organizations that they support that they expect them to actually do something, not to just take donation dollars and then hang out with congressmen in social settings. But they've got to actually do something. And so that's a message that could be communicated in your own way, in a personal, respectful way. Rachel, I think I've covered everything with you on this. And let me just say that your article, we're going to put it on our Facebook page so that people can read it. It's called Getting the Party of Infanticide on the Record. Rachel, again, works for Conservative Partnership, and she's becoming a national treasure with her faithful reporting on what's going on in Capitol Hill. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, talk to you soon. All right. Well, listen, we've got several problems, and so I'm here to tell you about most of them here, most of the ones that I can today. There's an article in the New York Post about socialism, and of course, a lot of things are being written about it right now, but I just want to point, because we have so many new socialists, our young people and Congress people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who seem to be singing the praises of socialism. And I want to just give you some percentages here. The Gallup poll reports that 57% of Democrats have a positive view of socialism. 57%. But if they are asked if they support small business and free enterprise, they do. So what's going on here? Because Democratic socialists don't seem to understand what socialism really is, which is government control of the means of production. It's nationalizing entire industries. And interestingly enough, you know, the new socialists will point to Scandinavia or Denmark or Finland or Norway or Sweden and say, oh, this is socialism. This is what we want. The truth is they are not socialistic countries. In fact, Danish Prime Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen has said, Denmark is far from a socialist planned economy. Denmark is a market economy. And so is France. And so is England. I mean, they all have private enterprise and are driven economically. The government does not own all the businesses, and that is the true socialist model. That is socialism. Venezuela is socialist. Cuba is socialist. Soviet Union is socialist. And we just really, really have to teach our kids and our politicians, it seems, about what it really means. And just to prove the point, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are both being asked about the horrors of the Maduro regime. Ocasio-Cortez was asked recently, and this is what she said, clip five.
I can be upset
As a democratic socialist, I'm wondering if what are your thoughts on the Venezuelan crisis that's happening right now, and if you would denounce the Maduro regime?
Yeah, so I think that, this is absolutely a complex issue. I think it's important that that we approach this very carefully. One, I am, myself, just like anyone else, is absolutely concerned with the humanitarian crisis that's happening. And I think it's important that any solution that we have centers the Venezuelan people and centers the democracy of Venezuelan people first. I am very concerned about U.S. interventionism in Venezuela, and I oppose it, especially when we talk about a figure like U.S. Special Envoy Elliot Abrams here. I think he's pled guilty to several crimes related to Iran-Contra, and I don't think that we should be, you know, I am generally opposed to U.S. interventionism as a principle, but particularly under this administration and under his leadership, I think it's a profound mistake.
Wait, okay, lots of things. So she did not condemn Maduro. She basically, she said it in a, what she's against is American intervention to help the announced president who was trying to get Maduro to step aside because Maduro cheated so profoundly that according to the Venezuelan constitution, he is not legally the elected president of Venezuela. And that's the basis upon which the Americans got involved with the president of the Senate, who is Guaido, who is now, honestly, the constitutional leader of the country by their constitution. So evidently she doesn't know that. And I find it interesting that she echoed the words of, remember it when Ilhan Omar grilled Elliot Abramson in that committee meeting a couple of weeks ago? We played the clip. Just, she snarled at him. She is, in her hijab, and he's Jewish. And she was so deprecating to him. And so she brought up things that happened during the Reagan administration of his involvement really defending the freedom fighters in Central America. And so so you see now Ocasio is bringing up the same thing, this Elliot Abramson, this Jewish former member of the Reagan administration, how icky. And you see the theme here, don't you? You see a theme. And by the way, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, this is a different story, but it looks as though it broke just in the last 24 hours that her chief of staff, who is Saikat Chakrabarty, who is, he's a successful businessman. He's in the tech company. And it looks as though he has set up use my words carefully. Let's just say they muddied the waters on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's PAC, Political Action Committee, so that people don't really know where that money is going. And it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it is actually illegal. It looks as though they may have broken some laws to do what they're doing. People are looking into this right now. Charges have been brought. Let's just say that campaign finance attorneys described the arrangement as really weird, an indication that there's something amiss. They said there was no way of telling where the political donations went, meaning they could have been pocketed or used by the company to pay off the books campaign operations. The arrangement skirted reporting requirements and may have violated the $5,000 limit on contributions from federal PACs to candidates. And there's a complaint that's been filed by the National Legal and Policy Center. So that will be, you'll be hearing about that today, and that's just interesting. But on the policies with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she weighed in a little bit on the environment. I want you to hear clip four just before we move to another little topic here. Let's listen.
I can be upset that I get 10 plastic bags at the grocery store and then have to toss out my plastic bags because the recycling program in the area is tough, and that's okay. All of these are not reasons to stop fighting. All of these are reasons to keep fighting. Mm-hmm. And these are all reasons and pieces of evidence to say, hey, we need to make it easier to recycle.
All right. So you see the priorities. It's just amazing. And to take this a step further, it's Alexandria who introduced the Green New Deal. She surely didn't write it. I guarantee you she didn't write it, but she's carrying the water. She's the face of it. Meanwhile, in Britain, Blythe Pepino, who is a British environmental activist who founded a group called Birth Strike, was interviewed by Victoria Derbyshire by the BBC, and this is what she said.
Our planet is in a kind of collapse. The natural world is collapsing around us, and that's actually happening right now. And I'm so disappointed by the response by our authorities to this crisis, and so freaked out by it. Everything that I've read, that I've basically last year I came to the decision that I couldn't bring a child into that. And I was asking around people that I know, put it a little bit out on Facebook, and realised actually quite a lot of other people are making this decision. Mm. And so we realised it was really
I'm going to interrupt
really
her.
Important.
So the group has about 60 different women. And you can hear, now look, she delivers that pretty dispassionately, but she's sitting next to a woman named Alice Stewart, has also joined her group, who is afraid to have babies now. And so Alice Stewart takes this further in this interview, and this is what she says.
Each day for me is a struggle. I really do I'm so depressed. I feel so hopeless over how, you know, I'm reading, just in the last couple of months even, that, you know, insect numbers are plummeting so fast. It now threatens the collapse of nature, that we're losing we're destroying biodiversity so quickly that threatens our food. And the UN have said that could lead to the risk of our own extinction. David Attenborough going on TV to say the collapse of civilization could come from this. And I know that is so hard to really sit with and take in. But I have done that, and that has led to just a fear that I've never felt before. And my decision for being on Birth Strike mostly has come from not wanting to pass that fear on to someone else. If we're in this situation now, you know, even since my parents had me, we've destroyed 60% of life on this planet. What would that be like when my child's my age? Will there be 10% left? That's not just to do with being, a nature wildlife enthusiast like I am. That's dangerous as well.
You know, I wanted you to hear that because I want you to hear the kinds of things your kids are being taught. This is nonsense. We've destroyed 60% of life on this planet since you was born. We have destroyed 60% of life on this planet since she was born. How old is she? I don't know, maybe 30 at the most. 35, really? And also the insect population has plummeted so much that we are in danger of, you know, ruining agriculture, of destroying the planet. This is the kind of nonsense that your children are being fed by their professors, by CNN. You know, I remember when I would travel to these remote areas of the world, I remember being in a hotel room in Thailand with geckos crawling on the wall. And I turned on, there was television. I turned on the television. It was CNN International. And all they talked about was the disasters, the climate, insects dying. That was a long time ago. This is the nonsense with which we are contending. And all the more reason why we must speak the truth as best we know it. And certainly, more importantly than the truth about insects, this is the existence of an almighty God who has created all things, and nothing is going to end until he says it's going to end, and it's going to end in his way. Humans do not have the power to do what these girls are describing and what CNN would tell us and what the environmental leftists would have us believe. We are not that powerful. We are more like the insects standing before a holy God. We just can't affect it that much. That is the truth. And so I hope you'll continue to listen because the news just keeps coming. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.